some time, right? I know that those of you who are in leadership roles that involve any kind of public leadership, like preaching, leading liturgy, teaching, gathering groups, you're always glad when they come back. So thank you for coming back. I know that it's a beautiful place, and there's a lot of other places to sit and be, and I'm grateful that you're here. So what I'd like you to do, you need something to write with, and either a piece of paper or one of the index cards that are floating around, or you need a tablet or a phone, something, and you need to put numbers 1 through 20 on your sheet or your tablet or your phone. I was recently with the school chaplains from your diocese and did an exercise similar to this. So I was talking to one of the people yesterday who was at that event, and I was talking about coming here and saying that I was concerned about duplicating things that some people would have heard. He says, oh, but you're going to do that thing with the numbers, right? I said, no, I wasn't, but he told me I should, so I am. I have more. Does anybody have extra index cards in their hand somewhere? Here's lots more. Here's a whole bag of them. Okay, 1 through 20. This is a very, very challenging quiz. As you're coming in, you're going to need something to write with and something to write on. And it can be digital or it can be paper. And 1 through 20, all you're going to have to decide for each of the questions is yes or no. Okay? I think you can do this. So you don't need a lot of room either. You just need a Y and an N. Number one. Were you baptized as an infant? And if you don't remember, put a question mark. Were you baptized as an infant? Number two, were you born in Virginia? Number three, have you ever been on a pilgrimage? Have you ever been on a pilgrimage? Number four, do you tweet? Number five, have you ever failed a test? Number six, GOEs count. Number six, I think they count especially, that's good. Number six, can you remember a family Bible? Well, the book, the actual thing. Can you remember a family Bible? Number seven, if you remembered a family Bible, was it read? Not R-E-D, R-E-A-D. Did you read it? Or did it, like in my house, it was a very pretty Bible that pressed flowers really well. I'd go for hikes and I'd slip those flowers between wax paper and put them in that big heavy Bible. Awesome. We didn't read it. Number eight, do you have a favorite movie? Number nine, do you have a spiritual mentor? Number 10, did you love Sunday school? Number 11, do you know most everyone in your congregation? Whether you are the leader of it or a worshiping member of it.
All 81.
All 81. What kind of bishop are you? Number 12. Looking across your extended family, do you see any ethnic and racial diversity? In other words, have people married outside your primary ethnic heritage or partnered? Number 13, were you ever a camp counselor? Were you ever a camp counselor? Number 14, have you ever witnessed a miracle? Number 15, have you ever participated in a civic demonstration? Number 16, do you know somebody living who is over 100 years old? living now. Number 17, have you taken an online course of any kind, for credit, for not credit, for fun, for driver's ed? Perfect. Number 18, do you have a child or a close relative who would qualify as a nun, N-O-N-E, someone who has basically left the church, is disinterested, might be a very, very good person, maybe doing lots of really incredible work in the world, but is not particularly active or interested in church? Number 19, have you or someone you know well ever lost your job? And number 20, do you like taking risks? Okay, anybody who said yes to number 10, if you are able, please stand. Church geeks, they like Sunday school, they like Sunday school, church geeks. Okay, before you sit down though, I want to hear a little bit about why you think you liked it, because I think there really were reasons that you actually, so shout out some reasons you think you liked it. Great teacher. Great stories. Do you remember anything about how they were told or taught?
They would talk like we sat around, and they would talk like there was a story, a bedtime story.
Did anybody have flannel boards? Is anybody old enough? Right? Right? And how awesome those were? Okay. Anything else? They let me play the piano. Agency, right? Permission. Not juvenilizing, not sort of diminishing their capacity. Wonderful. Another one. Lemonade and cookies. I wanted someone to get to snacks. Okay. Thank you. Please sit down. Oh, one more.
There was fellowship there.
There was fellowship there. There are so many reasons why we can do church well. And those were some very good examples. Remember the wedge already? So there was all of that there. Welcome would be cookies and juice, right? That's fellowship, but it's the, you know, it's my basic needs. I like snacks. Fellowship is the community, that second part. Being allowed to like hear the story and engage the story and ask questions about the story. Godly play is a very familiar to many of you. I wonder, can be a very real part of catechesis and growing. And then the ownership, the idea that I was allowed to play the piano. I was allowed to be part of the commitment and the leadership and take responsibility. I was a trusted member of this community. And that was all facilitated, which sounds like, by competent and loving adults, right? So there were relationships across generations. Great. Okay, how about anyone who said yes to number 5? And I'm right there with you. Okay, look around. This is by far the majority of this room, including at least one of our bishops. We have all failed a test. Now, before you sit down, why is that important? Why, as lay and clergy leaders of our church, is it important for me to remind us that we have failed a test? Seriously. Nobody's perfect. What's that?
More to come.
More to come, right? Okay, feel free to sit. What was that?
Failure is not fatal,
says Jennifer. Key point. Failure is human, right? If we believe in a God who forgives us for our sins, then we acknowledge that we make mistakes, and we acknowledge that there are things in life that are broken, some of which we have caused and some of which have been caused to us. But so often, the reputation we have on the street is that we're these pious, goody-goody, righteous people, and we hide our mistakes. And sadly, in some of our churches, we do hide our mistakes. That's not very often true and not always true, but we all know the tragic stories of congregations that have kept secrets, right? Congregations that have not been able to confess their truth in healthy ways. And so when we can joke about I failed the DMV test or I failed this or I didn't do well in the GOEs but I'm still a priest, whatever the story is, that's part of our humanity. It's part of what makes us real and relevant to people. I don't mean you have to put that on your forehead and walk around and say I'm a failure. That's not the case at all. But failing a test and thriving is a pathway towards fullness that we want people to know about. So it's both literal and metaphorical. We need to continue to practice being the human beings God created us to be, which means we are ever becoming more whole, but we still fumble and we still let him down, her down, us down, and it's important to remember that. Okay, how about number 6? Anyone who said yes to number 6? Look around the room. What percentage of the room is standing, would you say? About 60%? I think so, too. Okay, if you said no to number 7, sit down. Okay, I'll tell you in a minute. If you're standing and you said no to number 7, sit down. The people left standing are the people who grew up in families with Bibles that were read. As in read back and forth across the lines of words. So we have actually in the Episcopal Church kind of a biblical literacy challenge. We have a lot of us who say, oh, but there's so much, please feel free to sit. There's so much Bible in our prayer book. Well, there is. It's great. There's a lot of scripture in our prayer book. But if you don't know the Bible to know what portions of scripture and where they came from and why they were chosen and what the connections are between these rich prayers and texts, it leaves you with a very sort of fragmented notion of what this fundamental story of our faith and our tradition is. Anyone who is standing want to say something about a positive memory of reading the Bible as a family? From the Bible, and you'd sit around and read the Christmas story together. Excellent. Anybody else have a good...
Oh.
Do you hear that? So huge Bible, paper-thin pages. I was 4, and I felt so great because my dad would let me touch it and help turn the pages. That's really important formation. That's life-wide formation. It's not about just what's in the Bible. It's about the holy process of coming to the Bible. Yes? Say it again.
Wrote the family tree.
How many of us have Bibles with family trees in them? I do too. Right? I mean, that's an incredible, right? That's bringing your lineage into relationship with the lineage of God, right? And saying there's something about this marriage, this connection that really matters. That's lovely. Anyone else? Yes,
I was
Randy.
Say, my bedtime story every night is from the Bible. My mother would read every night.
That's great. My bedtime story every night was from the Bible, which says to me something about her mother knowing the Bible, right? So, you know, it's one thing, and it's a good thing, when we can give young parents a children's Bible that we think is a good translation with appropriate art and all of the, and say, you know, why don't you try this for bedtime stories? That can educate mom, dad, mom and mom, dad and dad, whoever, and child at the same time. But to have a mom who just knew the Bible well enough to draw from it is pretty remarkable. One more. Excellent point. I think that's a really excellent point. I would say that my family had more prayer books than it had Bibles in the Episcopal tradition, and I still think we needed a Bible. Do you know what I mean? The Missal is also a remarkably important text, but again, that's an enculturation into a tradition, and what I think a lot of us, in particular primary denominational or traditional identity structures, have inherited is a pride of place that is reflected in the practices of the tradition that sometimes supersedes the foundations that make us who we are as people following the way of Jesus. So in a world where everybody blurs it anyway, and denominations and differences are not clear to people, it's even more important for us to have our own language now of what my relationship is to the primary texts and the sources. So I think that's a very, very valid point, though. Okay, how about anyone who said no to number 1, please stand, or wave your hands if you're tired of standing. This is exciting. You were all not baptized as infants. So let's just for fun see who was baptized as the oldest person, okay? So anybody baptized 5 or below, go ahead and sit down. Anybody baptized 10 or below, go ahead and sit down. Anybody baptized 15 or below, sit down. Anybody baptized 20 or below? Ooh! This is awesome! Okay. When were you baptized?
24.
And what led to that in short form? And how did that happen at 24?
I had a mystical experience. I think God loved me. I was in England and came back to Charleston. And I was baptized in the St. Paul's Memorial. There's
better. Yeah. Is that amazing? So 24.
27.
And what led to that decision at that time?
Church and wanted to be baptized.
Mystical experience, conversion experience. These are real, folks.
Apparently, I can't count. I was 22.
Okay.
And I was in college, and I was a real rebel, and so the Episcopalians were it. I joined the church in 78, and they were arguing about all kinds of things, but I didn't care because they were using their brain. And
Good. So, yes. Good.
I didn't know I was baptized as an infant until my mother died, and we were going through her papers and getting rid of stuff, and I found baptism.
Wow.
I was raised in a fundamental church.
Right.
And I apparently was baptized by my mother, who was Catholic.
I was going to say, there was some Catholic or some other tradition sort of seeping in there, right? That's great. So I love it. Power, dynamics, this is great. In one sense, I wish I could just, I'm tempted to just let us loose to go tell each other our sort of narratives of faith. You know, we've done that a million times if we're in the ordination process, but there's something really very special about when we were baptized, even if it were as an infant, that when we awakened to that call, you know, when we realized that it really mattered, and the privilege of noticing that as an adult and choosing baptism. There's a lot to be said for believer's baptism. You know, there's a lot to be said for the willful decision that one has to make. And I think when we're in congregations, it's important to invite people to remember their story and to realize there's some diversity, even in your congregation, that can enrich our awareness of why baptism matters. So thank you for doing that. Okay, let's do... how about yes to number 12? I'm standing too on this. We are people who have extended family who includes people of other ethnic or racial backgrounds than our own. So, you know, we're about half the room, maybe not quite. But that means we know something of the 21st century writ large in our immediate extended family. That's pretty important to know because we still live in a very segregated world. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some demographics right now, but part of, I think, what helps us be engaged and curious and open to the experiences of people different from ourselves is when they come very close to home. You know, and we start to realize that I am privileged to know people whose life stories, whatever they are, ethnically, racially, economically, you know, different gender, whatever their experience is so different. So our families that become increasingly diverse are formative for us also. And we sometimes just take that for granted because so-and-so fell in love with so-and-so, right? And we think, oh, that's great. But all of a sudden, our life and our little picture looks different. Our genealogy isn't the same as a generation before us. So I celebrate that diversity. I think it's not always easy. It can be very difficult. I mean, religious diversity can be difficult. But to recognize that your own families have branched out and that you have been received into their extended family, I hope, is really an incredible gift of God. Diversity is God's creation, and it is a holy and wonderful thing. So thank you. I'm going to do a little jumping back and forth. Bear with me here for just a second. What I want to do to keep you awake is having you do this up and down, but I want to spend a little time. Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit about demographics. And right now, with that in particular sort of lens, I want to think just a little bit about something many of you in this room know much more about than I do, but the significance of the rapid changing demographic texture of our country. And in particular, the changing populations of Hispanic Latino folks in our communities. So in the 2011, the U.S. Census figures said that there were 52 million Hispanics in the United States, which is 16.7% of our overall population. That meant as of 2011, Hispanic-identified folks were already the largest ethnic minority in our country. 75.1% of Hispanics who were 5 and older spoke Spanish at home, and more than half spoke English very well. So part of what the myth that is often in the Anglo side of these conversations is that everybody Latino speaks Spanish as their first language. And what we know, of course, is that that's not true. There are many people who identify as Hispanic and Latino who don't speak Spanish at all. There are increasingly generations of young people who speak both languages very well and are incredibly gifted in the workplace and in school because of that, speak Spanish at home with their grandparents, speak English with their friends and their siblings, and live a very, very blended life. In the past decade, of course, we've seen incredible growth in Latino populations in certain parts of the country. There was 1.3 million increase between July 2010 and July 2011, just 1 year that was measured, and more than half of the 2.3 million total of the U.S. population growth in that time. 8 states already have populations of over a million Latinos, and I bet you can guess what they are. What was that? West, so Arizona, California, Colorado, Southeast, Florida, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, and Texas. Hawaii is yellow, and it's because it's a multi-ethnic. I mean, there's no ethnic majority in Hawaii, and so the actual growth rate of Latinos in Hawaii is uneven because it has a lot to do with the military, and it has to do with who's resident there at any given time. In Virginia, this little graph gives you a relationship between native-born, the green bars, and foreign-born, the yellow bars, from the ground being 0 years old to the top being 85 plus. So what you have here in 2012, you have 0 to 4, by far the majority are born in this country. Do you see that, the green? If you move up to the fourth bar up, that's 25 to 44-year-olds, the majority of people in Virginia in 2012 were foreign-born in that age demographic.
Born outside
Virginia. That's right. Very well said. So in Virginia, this is migrant populations in Southern Virginia, and it's Beltway populations in Northern Virginia. But what's so interesting about this is that 25 to 44 is the peak of the workforce, right? So we are living in a state that is blessed with extraordinary numbers of young Latino and Latina folk. And we need to be thinking about how not only our churches, but our communities can be enriched by the gifts that they bring.
And Asian, right.
That's more pocketed. And where people are living. I'm using the Latino numbers mostly because they're so significant across our whole country. So the estimates for July of 2050 are that there will be 132.8 million Latino Hispanic folks in this country. According to the U.S. Census, they will then constitute 30% of our population, which means almost 1 out of every 3 Americans will be Latino in 2050. And why? The big reason is birth rates. At various times recently, there have been as much as a ratio of 8 to 1 Latino births to Anglo births for all sorts of reasons, but there are significantly higher birth rates among Latino Hispanic communities. So be thinking, what does this have to do with us and where we are in ministry, in local settings? What is God doing in your midst? You know, how might we respond to this particular and, I think, exciting opportunity? Okay, anybody who said yes to number 13? We were all camp counselors. Okay, your bishops are standing. No wonder they're bishops, right? Okay, 3 pieces of wisdom you draw from your camp counselor or camping experiences that we can share with the room.
Rest period is the 8th sacrament.
I like that. I love that. Okay, that's a great one. Another one. Piece of wisdom you draw from camping experiences.
Days off should be celebrated.
Days off should be celebrated. I agree. And be sure you take them or you get cranky. Right.
Get dirty.
What's that? You get dirty. Get dirty.
Fire.
Lots of things with fire. Okay. Fire, get dirty, pay attention to your Sabbath, take your rest period, you know,
sing.
And sing whether you sing well or not, right? All the songs I can sing are camp songs. Black socks, they never get dirty. The longer you wear them, the blacker they get. Someday I'll probably launder them. Something keeps telling me, don't do it yet. Not yet, not yet, not yet. Please sit down. I can teach that song. It's around. It's fun. We draw from our life experience, obviously. I don't want to over-preference camp ministry, but I want to say to you that one of the things, we're going to talk tonight, tomorrow morning, a little bit more practically about, so what does all this mean? What are we going to do? How can we act on any of this? And one of the themes I hope to communicate is, across the Episcopal Church, if we spent more time focusing on adult formation, we would actually make an enormous impact in other domains of life, including youth ministry, children's ministry, and so forth. But we have so limited our formation, our spiritual and religious formation of adults, that we have these religiously, relatively illiterate parents trying their best to bring up children in faith, but without language and form. I think that camp ministry, and here we are sitting in the midst of a facility that offers an incredible camp program, I think smaller churches can do really well focusing on adults in their congregation, providing healthy and active opportunities for the children that they do have, and connecting those children and teenagers to programs that they share with other churches in their area, and with diocesan programs, and with summer camp programs that are sturdy and formative and memorable for those children, rather than all trying to be all things to all people. If you have 5 or 6 or 8 kids, you maybe shouldn't be trying to run a Sunday school out of the volunteer steam that you have. Maybe the better thing is to do intergenerational ministry with those children in important ways that interest them, and then get them to camp. Get them to vacation Bible schools that another church is doing. Get them to places where they can do service projects with other kids their ages when they're teenagers. Share, partner, build resources together. But camp, what I will say is, in all the research and all the literature about faith formation, the most transformative growth is measured, when it's measured, in residential experiences of Christian community. So those of you who went to seminary and had the privilege of being a resident in a seminary for a period of time, hard and challenging as some of that was, I think you will also admit it was formative in significant ways. The rhythm of worship, the rhythm of play, the rhythm of eating together, the rhythm of chores, the rhythm of telling bad jokes, you know, the rhythm of thinking you're madly in love and falling out of love and surviving, you know, all of that matters. So I cannot say enough about healthy camping ministries for children, youth, and adults, but retreats, all of those kinds of things. I just think those of us who were in them were formed by them, and we know that they made a difference. So. Okay, anyone said yes to number 4? Please stand. We are the brave souls who've crossed over into Twitter. So we tweet. Some of us tweet really well. I mean, look at someone right there who tweets really well. Some of us tweet moderately. Some of us just lurk and follow and watch and don't really know what's going on and have thumbs that are too big to do it well. But why is it important? Thank you. Please sit down. Why is it important that I ask you about Twitter? What is it about social media, Twitter? Why do I think that matters?
Kids don't use Facebook, they use Twitter.
Okay, so a generation younger than us or two are probably using a different medium to communicate, and they'll keep changing, right? I mean, they're on Instagram, and then they're going to be somewhere else. Now, Snapchat, the scary one for me is the calculator. What's that called? It's the one where it's got another name. It looks like a calculator, and it works like a calculator, but if you put the right passcode in, it's a false. Behind it are all these apps that kids can hide. So it's like a layering of, but I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, so social media.
Can you let us know what you remember?
Yeah, I will. And I will, in the middle of the night, I'll remember. I can't look at my phone because I don't have it, so no, I bet I can figure it out. Social media. I could talk for a long time about social media, and there's a lot of really good literature on it now. It's not an option whether we as church respond in that medium or not. That is the medium of communication, that being a domain, multiple domains, for many, many people, not just young people. You know, the fastest growing Facebook users are over 50. And of course, as we go on Facebook, us older folks, a lot of younger folks are dropping off, right? But there are so many ways to benefit from using social media well. And it's something that has been sort of terrifying for lots of people. It's something that has been delighting for others. It's very important to find people who know how to use social media properly and love to do it and can do it with you, whether it's for the congregation or whether it's for your personal account and learning how to practice. We, for instance, at VTS run a conference every summer called E-Formation. And the reason we do it is it's a laboratory for people to come and learn about digital media for ministry, particularly in formation, but in all walks of church life and communication. Because what we really believe is that it's not the tools and the bells and the whistles that matter. It's the language of our time that we need to be able to speak. So what you need to know is that the rule of life that I live online is message, method, then media. So the message has to be clear. What you want to be and who you are in the world doesn't change. The good news of Jesus Christ is no different in 2015 than it was in the first century. But how we communicate it so that people can receive it has to shift and change. We went from, you know, no printing press to the printing press. So we move through eras of communication. So message, message, method, then media. The method then is, who are the people I'm trying to communicate with? For what purpose? What do I want them to know? The method is different. I talk to my extended family differently than I speak to people in my professional practice. So what is the method of communication? I'm telling students in graduate school at VTS all the time, you know, I don't really mind that the email you sent me was sort of sassy and abbreviated, but I really think you need to pay attention. You don't normally send a professor, if I stand in that foot, you know, that kind of short, cryptic, you know, sometimes vulgar kind of sign off. It may be cute, but it's not funny. And you really need to think about how you're going to communicate, how that method of communication will work for you when you're a priest in the church out in the world. So then the medium is, what is the best medium? Is the person you're writing to, communicating with, reaching, an email user? Do they tweet? You know, is it a person who does go on Facebook? Is it a person who needs a piece of paper mailed to them? All of that's available. But we need to be more judicious about our time and our uses of technology so that they serve the end we are intending. Every church can't do all things digital well. Small churches don't have to have it all, but what you do, you need to do well. So, you know, what is deadly is a website that is horribly out of date. You know, don't just build it and then watch it sit there. Only build it with the circle of people who can support you in sustaining it and refreshing it. And then figure out, you know, what is it we want it to communicate about who we are. There's design, there's all sorts of thoughts about this, lots of good wisdom. But my point in asking you the quick question was, we need to take risks. Remember, one of the questions is, are you a person who likes risk? We need to be willing to risk in areas of common life that are unfamiliar. And there are mentors, and there are good YouTube videos, and there are ways of learning what we need to learn. And it's sometimes difficult, but it's worth it. That's how we become relevant. Yes to number, let's say no to number two. No to number two. We are those who were not born in Virginia. So it's a lot of us. Probably not a surprise, particularly in the professional practice of the church. But at the same time, please sit down. I think it's really important, especially for those of you serving in smaller communities or in more stable communities that are less transitory. Beltway communities tend to be quite transitory. That we stop to listen to the stories of people with deep roots. That they know that their localness, their sense of generational history matters to us as people who are still visitors 30 years later or 40 years later, right? We're still guests in this place. And I think that attentiveness, that listening, is part of that life-wide formation. What were the stories that made this place what it is? And what do you bring from your places of origin, your other places of living? What do you bring into this equation that mixes it up a little bit and challenges the question? We always tell our stories as if, you know, I was born here, and I lived there, and I got married there, and I went to college here. And geography matters. It matters a lot. And it tends to become blurred in our very fast-paced society. And I think we need to slow down and say, why do you still live in Virginia? What do you love about Virginia? Tell me about Virginia. How many generations go back? You know, and if there are people who are not white, chances are their stories in Virginia are quite layered and difficult. And there's a lot more to be told and a lot more to be listened to. So I just commend you to be attentive to geography. I also tell people all the time, try it once or twice to drive somewhere you've never driven that's some distance away without GPS. Use a map, like a paper map. You know, actually have to read it and realize that this little town you're going to is next to that little town, and oh gosh, I knew somebody in that little town. You know, GPS is amazing and wonderful, and we all depend on it, but it absolutely puts blinders on the sides of our faith. And you know, I'll get to somewhere and I'll think, I have no idea what I went through. I mean, I'm alert, I was safe, I paid attention to driving, but you miss the nuance of the life around you. So, okay, let's do, anyone yes to number 16? And I suspect if I'd asked you if you knew, have ever known someone over 100, more of us would have stood. So these are many of us, if you look around the room, who currently know somebody who's over 100. It was not long ago that living over 100 was an absolute human exception, right? So we now are looking at a world in which people are definitely, please sit down, definitely living longer, definitely living in general healthier, and have many more years of useful life than our traditional models of retirement would have suggested. So, you know, what's the retirement age? 65. Many of us in this room know that we will not be retiring at 65 for reasons either financial or motivational, right? We aren't ready to retire at 65. So in the literature, there now are classifications of old. So we have what we call young old, thanks be to God, because it's 65 to 74. So those of us who are 65 to 74, we are young old. Then there is old. You get to just be old. When you're 75 to 84, you're just good old. But when you're 85 and older, you are old, old. And I love that. If you've ever worked with preschool kids, you know, preschoolers emphasize things by repeating, like, it's hot, hot. You know, it's cold, cold. So she's old, old. Now, here's some important statistics. So the US already has more people 65 and older than the total population of Canada. And across the world, more people 65 and older than the entire populations of Russia, Japan, France, Germany, and Australia combined. We are an aging planet. It's increased life expectancy. We have more energetic lifestyles. In many cases, we have more education than we used to. And people are typically now living 20 to 25% longer and more actively in retirement than they did before. So the good news there is that the fastest growing age demographic in the world is 85 plus. The fastest growing age demographic is 85 plus.
Fastest growing in my church.
And the fastest in your church. And this is what we're gonna talk about. Instead of saying my church is all gray and old, what if we said these are the people God has brought to us in this place, right? What does spirituality look like over 65? The traditional pattern was you're going to be active in the church, you're going to pledge, you're going to teach Sunday school, you're going to be on the vestry, you're going to sing in the choir, you're going to help with the buildings and grounds, you're going to be on the altar guild, you're going to do all these great things, and maybe if you're retired and you're still healthy, you'll do even more of it. That would be great. We really need your extra time. Would you also do the luncheon? And could you do, you know, and it's just great. And oh, too bad you're shut in. Okay, we'll bring you Eucharist. There wasn't much there, and sometimes there still isn't much there for people in a deeper place of spiritual inquiry and discernment. How is your life changing? How are your beliefs changing? How is your sense of mortality affecting what you understand about what it means to be human and what you know about God? How is the loss of your peer group to illness and disease and aging affecting your sense of vitality? How is it affecting your sense of existential realities? We have such a curriculum waiting to be born in most of our congregations that we have not attended to. And it's exciting. It is really exciting. So, the new realities of older America. What you have here, the orange, the bottom of each of these towers, are 65 to 74-year-olds. The yellow strip are 75 to 84-year-olds. And the blue at the top are the 85-plus-year-olds. The old olds, right? So, this is 2010, 2030, and 2050 projected. And if you look at 2050, if the demographers are right, it's pretty close to one-third, one-third, one-third. Now, this has enormous implications for our economy. It has enormous implications for our tax system. It has enormous implications for our healthcare system. It has enormous implications for our educational system, because we tie school, you know, property taxes to school funding. And what we see, sadly, is as people age and no longer need schools for their own family, they don't want to pay taxes for schools. So, but it also has huge implications for our church. This one is even more telling, and sooner. By 2032, there will be more old people than children in the United States. So, right here, the blue line are the 65-plus-year-olds growing because of the baby boomers, right? And the orange line is the under 15-year-olds. So because of a combination of birth rate and baby boomers, we now, in 2032, are pretty reliably going to cross over and have more people over 65 in the United States than under 15. That's not long from now, in terms of all of the infrastructure that our country needs to adjust to accommodate the needs of these generations. The one exception will be immigrant birth rates. So this is where the Latino-Hispanic birth rates and Southeast Asian birth rates and a number of other immigrant communities having higher birth rates is actually hugely to our advantage. So these are total populations in from 1950 to 2050. And again, it just shows you that the portion of 65-plus-year-olds on this one, the blue, is growing consistently. So I'm going to show you a little piece of video that I think will be helpful.
Never in human history have so many lived so long. Data suggests that if we reach 65 years of age, it's likely we'll live to 85. We're living longer, and we're having fewer babies.
The aging society is about the fact that you have larger proportions of people over the age of 60 than you have who are under the age of 15.
And it's not just America that's an aging society. Europe, China, Japan, we're an aging globe. An aging society isn't just about old people. It's not just about baby boomers. Gen X will likely live longer, and so will millennials.
The baby boomers are an introduction to what will be a permanent shift. It is not the pig and the python, the large snake that swallows a pig, and you see that bulge going through the snake and then coming out the other end eventually. Well, ours never comes out the other end. This is a permanent state we're now in a remarkable shift.
And the shift will utterly transform our society, how and how long we work, how and where we live, how we organize our families, medical care, economic and political lives, how we organize our thinking. This will give you an idea of what's ahead. Right now, about half of us live in the suburbs, and it's where 75% of older Americans live and want to continue to live. But suburbs were designed in the 1950s for young families and the car. There's a disconnect there we have to deal with.
It's an old rule of thumb that if you can make the community work for kids, and if you can make the community work for the elderly, that it will work for everyone else.
Same with how we work. We think of 65 as a retirement age engraved in stone. But when Social Security was enacted in 1935, average life expectancy was only 62, 3 years less than a retirement age. Today, we can expect to live about 15 years beyond traditional retirement age.
There isn't anything in the psychology literature that suggests that it's good for people to go on vacation for decades.
Even if it were a good thing, few of us imagine retirement as a vacation anymore. Most of us haven't saved enough, and we're all worried, for good reason, about Social Security and Medicare. What if we reimagined our standard life course? We think of it now in three age-segregated boxes. Age 0 to maybe 25, childhood and education. Age 25 to 65, work, and more of it, raising a family, always crunched for time. Age 65 and beyond, little work, lots of rest. What if we imagined that that third box would start just 3 years before life expectancy today, say, around 75, not 65? What if we worked less in the middle of life and longer at the end? And what if we looked at aging and even our own mortality square in the eye.
Children in American society historically have only suffered losses that relate to their parents, for the most part. But today and tomorrow, they're going to suffer the losses of great-grandparents, of parents, of grandparents, and so on.
So here's the point. The world we live in, the people we've become, demographically speaking, are way different from 1935 or 1950 or even 1970. But our institutions, economies, policies, Social Security, Medicare, our communities, work, all were designed for who we were 50 years ago. They don't work for us today. So, are there rough waters ahead?
When we think about an aging society, everybody swoons. And oh my God. You know, they write articles about defusing the demographic time bomb. Why is there an assumption there is no upside?
Maybe because the upside requires change. Change we have to design, legislate, wrap our heads around.
As a psychologist, I'll tell you the very first step that is really essential, and that's that we begin to envision new models, new ways of being, new lives.
How will we come of age in an aging America? The conversation begins.
This is a permanent state we're now in.
So my challenge to us is to lead the way. I think as people of Christian tradition, I think as Episcopalians in particular, I think we have resources to draw on from our scriptures and from our faith systems that are hopeful and life-giving and will in fact create a vision for living well into longer and later years that society in general cannot find, that they simply don't have access to. Psychologists can tell us all we want about what our fear and our understanding of mortality means, but the only thing that I know that really trumps the anxiety about death is the promise of resurrection. The only thing that I know that really, truly takes the sting and the fear out of what will it be when I get to that place in my life is the confidence that I am loved and that I will be with God forever. And we have ways of talking about that that other resources do not have, other traditions, other disciplines do not have. So we shouldn't be ashamed of our older congregations. We should be mobilizing our older congregations to lead the way into prayerful, faithful aging. So yes, the first thing may be to start, you know, thinking about it and talking about it. I think the first thing is to pray. I think the first thing is to read some of our texts about some of the old wise people in our holy books. I think some of the things are to do are to interview some of our oldest members of our congregations and talk to them about their spiritual lives and what makes them hopeful and what has changed since they were 60 or 70. And begin to build confidence and resources around being a church of all ages. Doesn't mean we don't love children, doesn't mean we don't want children, but it means we are healthier adults when we are faithful to the call to be fully human from birth all the way to grave. So that's my little piece about aging, and we'll talk some more about how and what that might look like tomorrow. But I think we really have to turn this on its head. And the first thing people always say when I try to visit a church is, oh, I'm so sorry, we don't have any kids. And I, you know, there's times when that's actually a canary in the mine. There's a high school right next door, and there's, you know, there's a lot of children in the neighborhood, and there's a reason there aren't children in this parish, and that's a problem. But more often than not, it's a demographic reality that it would be very hard to suddenly have children in this particular church. And so who do you have? Let's talk about who God has brought together, and let's talk about what's happening in their lives. Okay, let's give you energy for a few more. Okay, let's do... anybody who said yes to number 17? These are people who took an online course of some kind, or maybe many. Can you raise your hand, those of us standing, if you actually were surprised by the community that was formed in an online course that you took? Did anybody have an experience? Okay, those of you with your hands up, everybody else sit down. Please stay up. Okay, would any of you be willing to share anything about what was surprising or what happened in the way of community formation? Yeah, Case.
So through the Center for Ministry and Teaching, I clergy, athletic professionals, actually all over the country. And the idea of interacting and making connections both just over voice and video chat, and then making a posting, and I had not had an online community that I've been a part of before, I started engaging and thinking about that community at times other than when I was online with them, and that was a completely unique experience for me in that moment.
Awesome. Thank you. Anybody else want to? Yeah.
I've been mentoring EFN groups face-to-face since 1982. The past 2 years, I've been doing online EFN groups.
Does everybody know what EFM is? Education for Ministry? It's a four-year adult formation program that tracks the, well, you could just tell what it is more than I can, but it's...
It builds disciples. Builds how to do ministry in your life, whatever your life happens to be. It's a very high contact sort of thing.
Right.
But it's just as high contact online as it is face-to-face, which has just blown my mind, because I thought they'd be some real difficulties with that.
Right. EFM is such a success story, because people who are EFM graduates or EFM participants are so devoted to their group, and being together is such an important part of their experience, and it is transformed into something that is portable to the online environment, which makes it accessible to people who don't have a group for hundreds of miles. It makes it accessible to people who have to work weird hours because they can join a group that's in a different time zone and it works for them. There's all sorts of reasons why an online community, I know people who chose an online EFM group because they were so saturated in the church community they were in, everybody knew everybody, and they wanted to be in a learning community that was with new people, fresh people. And so they chose to go online and had this kind of transforming experience. Dave, do you want to add something about?
Well, I did the same thing Ace did, but then I got to do it in the next cohort in you.
She's understated this. She was one of the leaders and the mentors of the second cohort of hybrid faith formation work that we did. So I didn't pay these people, I promise. These are testimonials, and what we're listening to are stories about three examples of what are called synchronous online learning. So there's asynchronous and synchronous. So synchronous means we're all online at the same time, and we're probably using a web platform that means we can see each other if we have a camera, and so we can hear and see each other and catch faces and reactions. That's very different from an online experience where it's asynchronous, where I post and then I wait and somebody else posts and then, but the interesting thing is, are you going to comment on an asynchronous course?
I'm not sure which one.
Okay, well, let me just finish my thought then. I thought maybe you were going to burst in. What I want to say is that I was part of an online writing course years ago, and it became an incredibly cohesive group of students from all over the country, different universities, and we never met synchronously. But because of this course design, it was so well designed that I knew that I had to post on Thursday by 3 o'clock. And Bishop Shannon knew that he had to respond to my post by 6 o'clock that night. And then somebody else had to respond. So it was very structured. You had to follow the structure. But in structuring the dialogue, it forced us into a place of engagement that was far deeper than a lot of courses that I have in experience in real time. You can't hide in online courses. You can learn things at your own pace, but if you have to report out, if you have, you know, you've got to report out. Equally, introverts can report comfortably and are not either silent or forced into speaking before they're ready. So there are huge advantages to these tools being available to us to imagine complementary and hybrid ways of doing formation and reaching members of our congregation or members of our school or our extended community in ways that we might not reach them if they actually don't physically come into the building on a regular basis.
So asynchronous. The delight for me was that I took a course and reconnected with people I haven't seen in
Awesome.
And that was total surprise.
Yeah.
And we've maintained those connections. So.
That's great. So I'm not here to say you've got to go home and plan an online course. That may not, but there are so many resources available to us now for free, both platforms and content. And there are places, and I don't mean to just be blowing the whistle of the Center for the Ministry of Teaching, but there are places you can go to, like us, that you can trust who are curating resources. And you don't have to just do a Google search and say, I need a thing on the Book of Job. You could contact us and we can give you access to good resources on the Book of Job that you could then offer to people in a variety of ways. They could still gather on Sunday between services to study the book, but they could also be involved in an online experience, watching a video, you know, reading a chapter of a commentary, and then commenting and then responding to each other in ways that are really life-giving. And people can do that from anywhere geographically. They can often do it with smartphones if they have such a thing. They can do it in languages that are their first language. So you could run an online course for a group that speak a different language than the primary language of your other courses. There's all sorts of ways of making something more accessible. But just be aware that those are exciting resources we have for available to us. Let's do one more, or 19. Anyone who said yes to number 19? This is more people than I expected, and I'm with you also. We have all lost our job at some point in our time. Oh, we have not. Okay, I'm sorry, I said no. These are the people who've been blessed to not lose their job. What? Or someone in your family. You're totally right. Sorry, I got too excited. I was trying to change slides. We are all people who either have lost a job or know someone who has lost a job. And that's a lot of us. Look around the room. It's a lot. Please sit down and tell me some things about why that's important. Why does it matter that we have contact in our lives with people who have lost employment? To be aware of pastoral care needs, absolutely. So being aware that losing a job is one of the sort of high stress, unexpected, or even if it's expected, very threatening dimensions of human experience, right? So pastoral care, being alert to that personally or professionally. What else?
It triggers an identity crisis.
It triggers an identity crisis. We are such a country driven on performance and what is expected of us. You know, we say, what do you do, before we say, who are you, those kinds of things. But the reality is, even people who think that that's not so important, when you suddenly lose your job, or you lose your job, and you are in the same circles of interaction with people, it's much harder to know how to exchange sort of pleasantries. It's harder to know what to say. I think it's also really important for the Episcopal Church to remember that we are not immune to economic suffering, and we are not immune to uncertainties in life. One of the myths, and in some cases reality, of our church is that we're wealthy. We increasingly have a lot more economic diversity in our church, thanks be to God, than we once did. But a perception that keeps a lot of people out of our involvement with us, is that they couldn't fit in, that they don't have the right clothes. My mother-in-law, for example, worships now at Christ Church in Alexandria. She loves her parish. And we tried to talk her into starting to go there a long time ago because she lives nearby. And she kept saying, I can't go to Christ Church. I don't have the right clothes. You know, she doesn't have, you know, she's a person who's retired on a fixed income. And we kept saying, they don't care what you wear. You know, just go. Oh, I can't. Those are those kinds of people, you know. Well, she finally went. And there are some of those too, right? But she finally went and people were gracious and welcoming and kind. And she wouldn't give it up for anything now. She loves Christ Church Alexandria. But she still will come home and she'll say, "Ooh, I talked to that man today. I think he's got a lot of money." You know, and that man, it was, you know, a general, or I mean, there's some pretty important people in that parish. But class and money is a silent part of our lives. And I'm not suggesting that you break open your coffee hour and say, hey, how much did you earn this week, you know? But I am suggesting that we need to be attentive to that. And among the reasons this is critical is that we live, as many of you know already, with the widest wealth gap ever in this country. These numbers are a little bit old. I couldn't find anything newer in a graph form. So these are comparing median net worth of the age of the householder, like the head of a house, between 1984 and 2009. So the beige column The little stubby columns on the left are 1984. And the beige column in both cases is 1984. And the green column is 2009. In the first pair, the short ones, are for houses held headed by people younger than 35. And the other are for houses headed by people 65 and older. So I've just convinced you that we're aging, right? We have more households now than ever headed by people over 65. Their wealth has grown so significantly in the time period between 1984 and 2009 that they are on average 42% wealthier than they were, whether they are young or old, than people who, than the younger folks at 35. So the 65-year-olds and older have gained 42% of their asset, their total net worth in that time frame. And the younger than 35 have gone down by 68%. So what we have is a widening gap between young and old, and a widening gap between poor and rich. This is just a sketch that I will confess is from a political site, so I think it's trying to make a point. It was all part of the 1% movement. But it's, if US landmass were divided, the US would look like this. So 1% would own this whole Northwest, kind of over to sort of Minnesota. 9% would own the East and New England. 30% would own the South and Florida. 20% would own what is basically Texas. And 40% would own the red dot. That's how uneven our economics have become. If you add race to the equation, it's even more gloomy. The wealth divide between the races was already dismal before the stock market crisis, and it only got worse. And it further dimmed the prospects for economic advancement for a lot of people of minority identities. So where we are now is that, according to the Urban Institute in 2010, white families on average earned $2 for every $1 that black and Hispanic families were earning. And when it comes to wealth, and that's the way they define wealth is the assets minus your debts. When it comes to wealth, white families far outpaced black and Hispanic families. And after the recession, whites recovered much more quickly than, and probably as often as 6 times faster than families of color. So we have this incredible wealth gap. And we, again, this speaks to me in radical ways to say one size doesn't fit all for church. You know, one model of belonging, one model of pledging, one model of participation. If you are poor and you're scraping together survival, the structure of your week looks very different than if you're a salaried employee in a secure job with health benefits. And so we know this intellectually. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But to the extent that we continue to do things the way we've always done them, and you know, run our programming according to middle, upper middle class life rhythms, we will continue to alienate and make not welcome people who might be very glad to join in this journey we have following the way of Jesus. We will continue to exile people who in fact have gifts to bring and join us. And I'm not saying they need to come and make us be like us. I'm saying come and change us. Bring their joy and their music and their wonder and their possibilities and make our life richer. So, yes to number 9. We all have spiritual mentors, and I'm grateful for that because we need to draw from those wise people and places. One of the things I was hoping you were hearing a little bit earlier when I was talking about the Dunns, the D-O-N-E-S's, we who are professionals in the church are not immune to being done. There are a lot of people in the church who serve God as faithfully as they can, but whose heart and souls are tired and who are going through the motions of practice as lay or clergy leaders. Our spiritual mentors can draw us back to center. We need mentors. We need spiritual directors. Please sit down. We need people who we trust, who will ask us the hard questions, who will pray with us, who will ask us about our spiritual practices, who will model their spiritual practices. We need people who remind us who we are, whose we are, and about the work that is required from here to the very end of time to continue to grow in a vital and significant way as a person of faith. It's not easy. It is radical. It is audacious. It is crazy. The baptismal promises you and I make and made and continue to reaffirm are really, really weird. They really are weird. They actually believe that all people are worthwhile. They actually believe that you and I are supposed to give away what we own and what we have. We are actually supposed to stop wars. We're actually supposed to be doing things to save the environment. We're actually supposed to believe that God cares about all of it. Not just sometimes, not just when it's convenient, not just on Sunday morning, all of it, all the time. It's impossible to be that vigilant and not get burned out. So we need practices, we need prayer, we need each other, we need mentors. I commend them to you. Remember to thank them. Okay, I'm going to let you off the hook here. We are basically done for the evening, anyway. So this is a little thing. It says, the assessment. Son, taking a good hard look at yourself is not the same thing as taking a selfie. My hope in asking you these questions for self-reflection as a jumping-off point for some of the things I wanted to share with you was not to navel-gaze. And it was also not to demonize the world. I am not a person who thinks that we have the sacred and the secular and we, you know, ne'er the twain shall meet. God is present with us in the church, and God is very present in the world around us. But what I am calling us to attend to by reflecting on ourselves is that, as they say in education, we teach who we are. You teach who you are indirectly, whether you are formally teaching or leading liturgy or visiting people in the hospital or saying prayers or putting together a rota. You teach who you are by the way you live and the way you move through life. And what I want us to know is our teaching can have a wider impact if we are more attentive to the people and the places around us, and if we bring with us the richness that is our story. If we pay attention to how God got us this far, and the choices we made, and the things that worked, and the things that didn't, and we continue to take that kind of inventory, you actually are equipped to be a former of faith of others in ways you cannot even imagine. If you are a person who has struggled with infertility, you have a story that when you're ready to share that appropriately with women who are struggling, you would be able to walk with them and relate to them and share with them what God has done to help you continue to have hope. If you're a person who's an incredible athlete and loves to run for miles, you know that that's a spiritual experience. Who would run with you? Who can you invite into that experience and reflect on it with them? So this is Jesus taking a selfie. He's holding up the camera. He's looking at the camera, and look what he sees in the picture. He sees the faces of humanity. Have a great night.